A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail?
Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
Dash cams, body cams, and unintended consequences. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is a special rebroadcast of To The Point. High-profile cases of questionable killings and other alleged misbehavior have police departments mounting cameras on patrol cars and on cops themselves. The idea is public transparency. But Seattle had 300,000 hours of dash cam footage, enough to keep 170 people busy for a year in response to a court order. Body cams don't provide surveillance of the police. It's mostly the innocent people they talk to. Should those interviews become public? Who should make the rules and implement the decisions day to day? On our talking point later, shipwrecks deep in the Black Sea cast new light on ancient trading empires. First, the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app. Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with a special rebroadcast of To The Point. The federal government is subsidizing dash cams and body cams for local police. What does the footage really show? Should the public be able to see it all? We'll hear about the need for balance between privacy and so-called transparency. Today's talking point, from cameras on the streets to cameras underwater. We'll hear how 40 shipwrecks exquisitely preserved in the depths of the Black Sea are shedding light on 1,000 years of maritime history. First, this news update. Next week, the House and the Senate will be trying to clean up leftover business from the Obama era before a newly elected Congress begins the Trump era next year. Is there any chance for bipartisanship? Jennifer Steinhauer covers the Capitol Hill for the New York Times. Always good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
Bipartisanship?
Well, some things have no choice. And principle, that would be spending, because the bill to keep the government running will expire on December 9th. That was a short-term spending bill, which Congress has been pretty fond of, as you know. And so they're going to have to come up with something on a bipartisan basis to continue to fund the government through some period, maybe not for the rest of the fiscal year, but at least to continue to fund the government. There's also a possible effort being made to pass a final version of a health care bill, I guess you would call it. It's a regulatory bill, too. It's called 21st Century Cures, and it would finance increases in medical research and some change some regulations that would expedite medical research. This is something that both sides of the aisle and both chambers would like to do, especially for Vice President Joe Biden, because it includes the cancer moonshot, which is close to his heart, of course.
It's also something that Mitch McConnell, the Republican majority leader, wants as well, the senator.
Yes, he's very interested in this, in part, again, because of the cancer moonshot. It's something that he's discussed being able to do with Obama as recently as 2 weeks ago. He spoke to the president about it. Mitch McConnell has been a fan of trying to do what's possible on a bipartisan basis. Of course, he, like all the Republicans in Congress, can't wait for President Trump to come in so they can do things that are partisan with him. But in the meantime, in the interim, he's been interested in bipartisan legislation that can pass on a modest or mid-level. This would count. He also has a personal interest in regenerative medicine, so he has a sort of personal and political stake in that bill.
Is there anything that the Republicans might want to do to sort of set the stage for Donald Trump?
Well, I would return back to the beginning of this conversation where we talked about spending. The incoming Trump administration has requested that Congress pass a bill in the lame duck that would fund the government through March. So that would be basically 3 months. I don't know if they picked that number out of a hat, but the House is eager to accommodate them. Now, the Senate Republicans, and some people in the House too, but particularly the Senate Republicans, particularly Mitch McConnell, see a big problem with that, because they realize that just as they're trying to get going in the first part, the first days of the Trump administration, they would be launched right into a spending fight, and they don't want to do that. Democrats think that's great, but they don't want to do that because they want to do other things. So we will see over lame duck what they come up with. Originally, the House said, yeah, we're going to do it through March, and the Senate said, wait, not so fast. So already you're seeing Republicans fighting each other and the House and Senate.
Lame duck, of course, is what's left this year as opposed to what will begin next year. Are there differences on this between the House and the Senate?
On the spending bill?
Yeah.
There are. The Senate really does want to have a long-term bill. If it were up to Mitch McConnell, they would fund the government through the rest of the fiscal year into the summer and leave spending conversations and for the next president and the next year. Of course, this makes appropriators really mad because they've been working all year on appropriations bills. They've had trouble finishing them. They've had trouble passing them. They've had trouble getting to the president's desk, but they want to. They don't want to waste a year's worth of work, especially in the House. So there are definitely differences of opinions on what should be done, and I think that we will see some interesting discussions of that next week.
The president-elect, of course, does not have a day of experience in government, but the vice president-elect does. How important is Mike Pence going to be?
Well, it's interesting. We've all been looking for clues, both on the micro level of who will be important on the Hill and who will seem to be representing the administration, who has the power. And right now, definitely does look like Mike Pence. Of course, he took the helm of the transition team from New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, as we all saw. He does seem to be the main conduit to the Hill. He's already been up there. He met with Paul Ryan. They started already talking about budget processes for next year and ways to unravel Obamacare, which, you know, is one of their first priorities, if not the first priority. So he will have a lot of sway. He has a close relationship with Paul Ryan, of course, from the House, the Speaker of the House. So it looks like he will play a very pivotal role so far. It looks that way anyway.
Now, Governor of Indiana, formerly, of course, a member of the House. What about the National Defense Authorization Act? That sounds big, but I take it there might be some action there?
Well, there's supposed to be. It is a bill that has to be reauthorized every year, and it doesn't have to be done in lame duck, but that's been the case in the past few years. And there's always, it's a broad policy bill. It covers a whole host of areas, and there's always a few firecrackers in there. Of course, as we saw in the lame duck session of 2010, that's where we saw the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, when the very waning days of the year right before Christmas as part of the defense bill. This year, there's some other interesting components, including the fact that the House bill does not include, but the Senate bill does include, a provision for women registering for the draft, now that women are in all combat roles in the military. Kind of controversial, something very interesting to see. Of course, the whole kind of politics around the defense authorization bill changed when Trump was elected and started talking about waterboarding, because there are provisions that passed in last year's bill that specifically prohibit those types of enhanced interrogations, as they call it, making waterboarding illegal.
Jennifer Steinhauer with The New York Times, many thanks.
Thank you for having me.
In a moment, dash cams, body cams, and unintended consequences on To the Point from PRI.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program, Morning Becomes Eclectic, can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_KCRW. KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren, I'll be back with To the Point. Body cameras have been promoted as a solution to police misconduct, but the strange two-year saga of Seattle shows just how complicated total transparency can be. That's the lead of a story in the New York Times Magazine this fall under the headline, Should We See Everything a Cop Sees? The author is Mackenzie Funk. Good to have you on our program, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So we're talking in the case of Seattle, not about body cams, but about dash cams. But the case, the two-year case that you talk about, does illustrate a real serious problem with all this footage that's been compiled. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, I was struck early on in talking to someone at the Seattle Police Department, in which he told me never has any technology in the history of policing been adopted as quickly as body cameras. And this is basically before many departments had policies in place to deal with them, before we had the technology on the back end to deal with all the footage, before state legislatures had rules about them, and really before social science had been done. And what happened specifically in Seattle was that right before Ferguson, which of course is one of the big reasons everyone said we want body cameras, there was a Supreme Court case, Washington State Supreme Court case, that said more or less all police video should be releasable to the public. And it was based on dashboard cameras, but of course it happened right before all of us started looking at body cameras, which are, compared to dash cams, they're perhaps more intimate, the footage. Consider that they can go into homes, they can go into hotel rooms, they see exactly what an officer sees, which if it's a close-up of someone having a mental breakdown, is a close-up in full view. So the privacy implications of body cameras are even more, and it was quickly seen that right as Seattle and other police departments around the state were starting to look at body cameras, that any footage they collected would too be subject to this new rule.
Now, as you indicated, the technology was installed when the law really hadn't been updated yet to accommodate it. So what happened in Seattle when the judge ordered that all the dash cam footage should be released?
Well, right after that, someone requested all of it, and not just from Seattle, but from every department in the state. And he's the main subject of my story. He was anonymous at first. He eventually came out. His name is Tim Clemens, and he believes very much in transparency. And he is a hacker. He's a programmer, and he was able to find a way to quickly request every bit of footage. And when he got it, he started putting it up on YouTube.
And what did this mean in terms of the effort to uphold the judge's decision and release all the footage? How much footage did they have? How many people were needed in order to just screen it?
Even before body cameras started really being used by police forces across the state, and just talking about Seattle, the amount of footage they had, surveillance and dash cam, was something like 300,000 hours. It was 1.5 million individual dash cam and surveillance videos. And I think it was in the order of 300 or 400 terabytes. And so there are really two problems here. For police departments, one of them is purely logistical and financial. It's the fact that to go through all this footage and to remove or redact the few things that are meant to be removed under privacy protections is a huge task. As anyone who's ever tried to edit a video knows, it's not one-to-one. An hour of video can be 5-10 hours of work, and it makes it almost impossible to, in fact, release everything that they had on their servers. That's one problem. And the second one was, under those same privacy rules, you can't actually redact that much. More or less, everything has to go out. And so people started seeing things that police officers see, but that the public may not have much use in seeing, but was still seeing anyway.
What sort of things? What's prohibited?
Well, prohibited are the law has changed, but at the time, prohibited were a few things. In some cases, the faces of minors, but not in all. Victims of sexual crimes in some situations, but again, not in all. And what I personally saw on YouTube was, an old man who admitted to having a past of drug use and having PTSD, having a mental breakdown. And the police officers were telling him he had been screaming for a month, and he was just incredulous. You can see it. It's like this real-time view of this fellow. I saw a young woman accused of prostitution in a hotel room tell her whole life story to an officer who wasn't trying to arrest her. He was seemingly trying to get her help and understand where she was coming from and try to shut down prostitution, but not, in fact, get her in trouble. But in the end, on YouTube was her address, her name, her email address, all these very private details about her boyfriend and how her parents were, things like that.
Mackenzie Funk, again, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just wanted to remind our listeners, you're Mackenzie Funk, and you're the journalist who wrote the New York Times Magazine cover story, Should We See Everything a Cop Sees? Chad Marlowe is Advocacy and Policy Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. Thank you very much for being on our program.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What's the answer to that question?
Well, I think Mackenzie actually nailed it right on the head in the beginning of his discussion with you, which is a lot of body cameras, when they were originally rolled out, were done so without having any firm policies in place. And so really, you know, with respect to what the public sees and what the public doesn't see, you know, we really need to look at body camera policy as a challenge between, on the one hand, wanting to promote greater police transparency and accountability, and on the other hand, to protect individual privacy. And so the types of policies that we need to be put out, and in cases like Washington State, that certainly involves writing a body camera state policy that adjusts the governing FOIA law, which is a Freedom of Information Act law, to strike a better balance. So you start from the premise that most body camera footage, 99% of the footage that's captured by body cameras, is going to be kind of meaningless from a larger view. You can think of a person asking a police officer where the closest gas station is. But there are certain select types of videos that are what led to body cameras in the first place. And principally, we're talking about body camera videos that shows police uses of force or videos that become the subject of a complaint against the police department. Those videos and those videos alone are the ones that need to be immediately made accessible to the public so they can better understand how they are being policed by their local and state police departments. But the rest of the videos, some of which Mackenzie described in what is obviously troubling detail, really there is no benefit to the public having access to those videos. And those videos should remain private, and they should be deleted in fairly short order by the police departments that capture them.
Chad Marlowe with the ACLU, one of the organizations that has often called for transparency and accountability, particularly in the aftermath of police killings, is Black Lives Matter. Malkia Cyril is executive director for the Center for Media Justice, and she is a Black Lives Matter leader in the Bay Area in near San Francisco. Thank you so much for joining our program.
Thank you for having me.
What sort of rules do you think ought to be applied here? And should, as we just heard, body camera video that shows police interviewing people in cases where there's force been used or where there have been complaints, should it all be released immediately?
You know, I think the real question is, I mean, so, yes, there are rules proposed by a set of civil rights principles that we endorse that will help protect privacy, that will help ensure accountability and oversight. But I think that the more important question here is that body-worn police cameras aren't a viable substitute for comprehensive police reform in the 21st century. And the fact that so much has been put on body-worn police cameras as a means of accountability, it's misplaced. It's a false solution. It doesn't work. I think we've seen that it doesn't work in the case of Tamir Rice. We watched that on video, and no one was held accountable. I think over and over again, we've seen that. We've seen it in the case of Laquan McDonald, where the dash cam cameras, the body-worn cameras, all of that footage was withheld from the public. We've seen it in the recent cases in North Carolina where, the police chief and the mayor, you know, in collusion, like, refused to release any parts of the footage. And all of that is really to protect police officers from accountability. So the question isn't whether or not everything should be released. The question is very specific as to whether or not data, images that are relevant in the case of police misconduct need to be released to the public, and absolutely they do.
What about this question of privacy?
You know, what's real is this, is that the fact is we don't have real mechanisms for privacy. And the issue and the problem to me is why have police cameras been allowed to proliferate, right, in police departments all across this country without this kind of protection? This is basic civil rights, constitutional protections for those who will be affected. You don't put unproven technology that doesn't have a clear legal framework out on the street. You create that legal framework. You ensure that that technology works before you put it in the hands of police officers as a tool and ultimately as a weapon against the communities that they are supposed to protect and serve.
Michaela Searle, once again with Black Lives Matter in the San Francisco Bay Area. Jim Bierman has joined us. He is president of the Police Foundation. That's a research and advocacy group. He is also former Redlands police chief. Redlands, a city in Southern California. Jim Bierman, Chief Bierman, thanks a lot for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
How do you answer the question just raised? Why is it that so many departments are already installing dash cams and even body cams without there being a general set of rules that have been agreed upon about what should be released and what shouldn't be released and how it should be used?
So theoretically, I agree with the statements that were just made. But the reality of policing is that it just doesn't quite work that way as much as we wish that it would. There are almost 18,000 independent police agencies in the United States. The federal government, which could serve as a unifying entity, has almost no ability to tell police agencies what to do unless they're under a court order or there's some action on the part of Congress to link funding, for instance, to specific policy. I think police chiefs and sheriffs all over the country are trying to be responsive to community demands for body-worn cameras. It is very clear that this is happening, and it's going to happen. I think in 5 years, body cameras will be as commonplace as an officer's handcuff, radio, or gun. And as we move forward with this, the protocols, policies, and the individual state regulations will evolve to catch up with that. But the demand at the community level is such that people are not going to wait until all of that gets worked out, because that's a lengthy process. And so I think that police chiefs, we hear this constantly across the United States, are attempting to be responsive to the demands of their communities. It's a messy process. It's not perfect by any means, but I do think that they're trying to do the right thing.
Well, we just heard from Black Lives Matter, or a representative of Black Lives Matter, which has been very much in the forefront of demanding accountability. But what do you say to her concern that the video can and often is used to protect the police officers rather than to demonstrate whether or not they actually committed some sort of malfeasance?
Well, this is the problem with parsing video. What makes a lot more sense, in my opinion, is that you either release the video or you don't. When you release video in a selective manner, then it lends credence to the argument that you're just trying to support the officer's statement, or you only release video when the officer's actions appear to be justified on the video. And again, this is part of what I think is this very messy policy evolution that we're starting to see that reflects the reality that there really is no national coherence on many aspects of policing. We would suggest that agencies release video and you just release it all.
Release the whole thing.
Yeah, it's, you know, this is, there's going to be some exceptions to this because there is a whole side to this that relates to the integrity of the investigation and not creating prosecutorial problems in court. But having said that, the standard by which the community, I think, has an expectation that the police are going to release video is different than what the challenge of the prosecutorial challenges district attorneys face or investigators may face. And this is all part of what's being worked out now.
So they could be giving away their case or they could be affecting potential jurors.
Yeah, you can create obstacles and maybe even prejudice the prosecution of anybody, whether that's a police officer or one of the citizens they're interacting with. And so prosecutors have a different perspective on this that's based in the law and their ability to prosecute cases.
Okay.
Investigators have the same kind of concerns.
All right. We're going to come back. We'll get a response to that, and we'll carry on this conversation. We'll talk about how to deal with this new technology that's going to be implemented, even though the rules have not been decided on. On our talking point later, shipwrecks deep in the Black Sea cast new light on ancient trading empires. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI. We'll be right back.
subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune Download podcast. To receive a free song of the day, find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
Warren, only back with To The Point. Like it or not, dash cam videos, body cams on police officers are in fact being installed all over the country in response to the demand for accountability. That's according to Jim Berman, who is the former chief of police in Redlands, California, now president of the Police Foundation. But that causes a lot of problems. He says that it all should be released and made available to the public. Let me go back to Malkia Cyril, the executive director for the Center of Media and Justice and Black Lives Matter leader in the Bay Area. What do you say to them?
I mean, look, in the 80s and 90s, politicians told us that the reason that mass incarceration became a reality was that communities were demanding incarceration. But in fact, communities then were demanding safety, just like communities now are demanding accountability. Communities are not demanding cameras. They want accountability. It's just that cameras are the only solutions being offered. They're a false solution. Let's talk about real solutions. Ella Baker Center has a Truth and Reinvestment Project. Patrice Cooler is one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter, is putting together a project that's working with the ACLU on their mobile justice app, right, that's trying to help people respond, produce rapid response networks that can respond instead of police, especially in cases of dealing with a mental health crisis. Alternatives to security and accountability are possible. Policing and body-worn cameras are not the only option available. So framing this as though this is the police responding to a need or a demand of the community, that's just it's not. I don't think that it's accurate. I think that what's more accurate is that instead of comprehensive police reform, instead of any legislation to keep our communities safe, police officers and police departments have gotten new shiny tools in their toolbox and are being rewarded for police violence and intimidation. That's what I see happening.
Do you think then that they ought to eliminate the dashboard and body cameras?
I would say that body-worn police cameras, dash cam cameras, are not a tool for accountability. They are a tool for policing and a tool for surveillance. So if, you know, I'm not going to take a position on whether or not they should be eliminated. I'm going to say that they should not be framed as a tool for accountability. They do not increase police accountability. They, you know, officers and police departments that withhold the video, in the case of Laquan McDonald, the parts of the equipment were intentionally destroyed. I mean, we have seen corruption on multiple levels using these body-worn cameras. We know for a fact that over time, police will adapt to the use of them to continue to maintain the current status quo of police violence. So. These are not the answer. Whether you keep them, whether you eliminate them, comprehensive police reform and transforming our understanding of policing and security, that's the answer.
Malkia Cyril, Black Lives Matter. You've mentioned a number of separate incidents. We don't have time to go into any of them. But let me introduce Harlan Yu. He is a technologist at Upturn. That is a nonprofit that looks at technology and policy. Harlan Yu, good to have you on our program.
It's great to be on.
You've taken a look at how these cameras are being implemented, what sorts of rules are being applied, and you, as I understand it, have a system, a sort of rating system, to determine where it's being done well and where it's not.
We do, yeah. So my organization, Upturn, together with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, put together a police body-worn camera policy scorecard where we looked at 50 major police departments across the country and scored the department body-worn camera policies across a number of civil rights factors. And what we found in our study across the nation was an overarching failure of the policies that departments across the country were adopting to provide transparency and to protect civil rights. You know, people oftentimes think that, you know, just because the police department adopts body-worn cameras that suddenly we're going to automatically have accountability. What we've seen in high-profile incidents across the country is that this is just not true, right? We have body-worn cameras on officers. Sometimes, you know, in Charlotte, the body-worn cameras were not on. In Baton Rouge, the body-worn cameras fell off. In Chicago, the body-worn camera captured before and after the shooting, but not during the shooting. you know, we need better rules of the road and better discipline for officers when they're not respecting the rules that have been put into place. Going back to what was talked about earlier in this conversation, I think one major failure that we're seeing across the country is providing transparency into the footage that actually eventually does get captured. Obviously, we do need to balance transparency with privacy, but in most jurisdictions across the country, even recorded individuals who are captured on camera don't have the right to get access to that footage, especially if there was a use of force or if they're trying to allege police misconduct.
Let me go back to our chief, Bierman, former chief of the Redlands Police Department, president of the Police Foundation. What do you say to that? It sounds like an argument for what we heard from Malkia Cyril, that, in fact, the cameras are not being used for accountability, or at least not effectively.
So, you know, I would agree with many of the statements that were just made from both the other guests. But I want to push back just a little bit. The statements that are made, I think, would leave some people to believe that this is the state of policing in every part of the country and this is the way it's done everywhere. And that's just not true. The technology is evolving. I think body-worn cameras today are a bit clunky and are a lot like the cell phone cameras of the 80s. Only just recently has one of the vendors put out a product that automatically turns on the camera when an officer pulls his or her weapon from their holster or their taser from the holster. And I think to understand why officers push the button or don't push the button to activate the camera at certain parts in the sequence, clearly sometimes they're probably not doing it when they should because they don't want something on film. But you also have to understand what is going on in those violent interactions. And at the officer is trained and has a legal right to, and a moral right to defend themselves if that's the situation. So the last thing that they're thinking about is pushing that button while they are trying to stay focused on what's happening in front of them. So part of the solution is having better technology that automatically activates and has more than one lens on it. So you get almost a 360-degree coverage and is better equipment. The scientific studies around the use of body-worn cameras consistently show that agencies that use those realize a reduction in use of force cases and a reduction in complaints. So they're clearly valuable, but I think Malkia made a valuable point. Nobody should think that body-worn cameras are the solution to the problems we're having in policing right now. There are going to be a multitude of things working in concert together that help reform police practices and increase trust and confidence in communities and places where that is absent.
Still with us, Chad Marlow, the Advocacy and Policy Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. You were the one who said in the first part of our program that 99% of what is recorded is, in fact, meaningless, and it's very important to have then a kind of censorship policy, or that's probably the wrong term to use, but a policy of determining what it is that is necessary to release and appropriate to release and what isn't. It sounds to me as if the chief is saying there's going to be more and more of this. Is this going to increase the kind of problem that you have raised rather than decreasing it?
Well, certainly the more cameras that are put out on the streets, the more risks there are to privacy. But I think that, you know, it's important, though, to step back. And I want to echo something that Malkia said, which is that in no way is putting a tiny lapel camera on a police officer going to solve or even make a significant improvement in the problems that are plaguing police practices and racial justice in this country. But I also think another point that she made that is worth repeating is that body cameras can not only fail to be part of the significant solution, they can also be part of the problem. And if we are releasing videos of, you know, people having their worst day out in public, they drink too much, they act like a fool in public, or if we release videos of someone who is the victim of domestic violence or wants to help the police with an investigation, they may not call the police at all. So we need very clear delineations. We need to understand why are these videos being recorded. They're being recorded to give the public better insight into policing in critical cases. Those are the videos that not only should be captured, but they should get to the public automatically with no discretion. And everything else should be withheld. And that's how we draw the lines. And yes, technology will advance, but at the end of the day, even if we have 360-degree cameras that turn on automatically, that's still not going to do anything for the public if they have no right to see the videos, and it's still not going to get to the underlying problems that are really plaguing policing practices and criminal justice in this country.
Harlan, you at Upturn, what about your policy scorecard, and what does it show in terms of the ability of departments to make the kinds of distinctions that Chad Marlowe of the ACLU is proposing?
Well, I think there is a way forward to balance transparency and privacy. At a minimum, one of the best practices that we're seeing across the country is allowing recorded individuals special access to footage in which they're a part of. So in D.C. and in Las Vegas and in Cincinnati, if you're a subject of a body-worn camera recording, you can walk into a district station, fill out a form that states the approximate time and place that a particular incident happened, and schedule a later time to go watch that footage together with your lawyer. At a minimum, I think that's at least one possible way forward where we can balance both the transparency needs of the community together with the privacy needs of those individuals. At the same time, I think there's another category of footage that's important for the broader public to see, certainly with police shootings and other unnecessary uses of force, high-level uses of force. And perhaps there can be other policies that attach to those kinds of videos. But I agree with Chad that, you know, we need to balance transparency and privacy. Body-worn cameras are extremely powerful technologies that can both shine a light on police brutality and also violate somebody's privacy. I mean, imagine an officer that arrives at a scene of sexual assault. We need to be very thoughtful about the policies that are being put into place. And right now across the country, we're just not seeing the rules of the road that will both provide for transparency and also protect people's civil rights.
Malkira, Cyril, back to you. Would that make you more comfortable if people who are, in fact, the subject of body cam footage would be able to view it? And if they have a problem with it, should they be able to act in some way to try to get it held back rather than revealed?
I mean, absolutely. The fact is that the power of body-worn cameras is really, at this point, I think, in the hands of the police. Do communities need an appeals process, a way to get access to it? Absolutely. And I leave that to the attorneys and the technologists that I work very closely with to figure that kind of stuff out. But what I think is important here, you know, in your question is this. Since the murder of Trayvon Martin in 2012 by George Zimmerman, which was the case that inspired the birth of the Black Lives Matter Network, we have seen no comprehensive legislation, no real legislative solution to address the problem of police violence. What we have seen is the rolling out of body-worn cameras. We've seen millions and millions and millions of dollars provided to police departments to purchase body-worn cameras. We've seen, we understand that it's going to cost millions more to store that footage. We've seen a lack of clear transparency, a lack of oversight rules. And the fact of the matter is that in between 2012 and 2016, without any legislative solution, we've watched technology become the solution. And we've had to watch instead, right, 12-year-old Tamir Rice be killed over and over and over again on camera, but no conviction, no one held responsible. That's our relationship right now to these cameras.
Jim, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're running short of time. Jim Bierman of the Police Foundation, I think you have conceded a lot of what we just heard, but what about the practice of allowing police officers to see the video that's been shot, particularly when it's been shot from cameras on their own bodies, before they make up their reports? A lot of people complain that that gives them a chance to adjust their testimony for later accountability hearings and so on, and that they should not be allowed that.
Well, this is controversial, and not everybody agrees within the policing community, so you'll see policies on both sides of this. Some people believe that if what you're trying to get to is an accurate statement based on the footage and the officer's recollection, you ought to let them look at it. If what you're trying to do is just get an independent recollection from the officer, and that if that is different from the video, that doesn't mean he or she was necessarily lying. It means that they have a misperception of those events. And as brain science and memory science advances, we know that there's lots of confusion in this. So they,
okay.
I just want to make, can I make one other point?
Very quickly, if you will.
Yeah, just officers like these cameras because in many cases they exonerate them from the claims that people make against them. So there's another side to this coin that people ought to just remember, that sometimes that camera is that independent witness that can either exonerate an officer or prove that the officer was wrong. There's two sides to that particular coin.
Two sides. But Harlan, you, with Upturn, who has the policy scorecard, Malkia Cyril pointed out that it is, she thinks it's most often used to allow officers to justify what they have been doing. What did you find out in that context?
Yeah, this is one of the most hotly contested points in the policy, in the body-worn camera policy debate right now. What we've seen across the country is police departments allowing their officers to view footage before they complete their written reports. My belief is that that creates an uneven playing field, because officers always get the opportunity to watch that footage where other witnesses don't. So to put it another way, let's say you're an investigator and you want to get to the truth of what happened in a particular incident. And let's say you have body-worn camera footage of that incident. You know, it's highly unlikely that if you're going to go interview a witness about what happened and what he or she actually saw, that you would take that piece of body-worn camera footage and show it to that witness and say, okay, I want you to tell me what you saw, but before you do that, why don't you watch the tape first and then tell me what you saw? Obviously, by watching the footage, that's going to skew the person's recollection about what that person remembers. And what we want with body-worn cameras is an independent source of evidence, where the body cameras show one particular perspective and the officer's memory is another perspective, right? Cameras might not capture everything that the officer saw. Maybe the officer's head was turned. Maybe the camera has additional capabilities that the person doesn't have. For example, night vision technologies. And so I think it's really important that when the policies are put in place by departments, that officers are always required to have a initial report before watching the footage. And we're not saying that they can't eventually watch that footage, but that the, okay, the officers need to, you know, write an initial report, then watch the footage, then write, you know, whether there are any discrepancies between the initial account and what the footage actually shows.
Okay, I think we've established two things. One is that this technology is coming. It's going to be more and more sophisticated in the days to come. But the rules of how to apply it and how it should be used are very definitely way behind the installation of the technology itself. We'll talk about it on future programs. Harlan Yu, again, a technologist at Upturn, which looks at technology and policy. Chad Marlowe with the ACLU. Jim Bierman, the president of the Police Foundation, former chief of police in Redlands, California. Malkia Cyril, a director for the Center of Media Justice and a Black Lives Matter leader in the San Francisco Bay Area. And our earlier guest, Mackenzie Funk, who wrote about all this and what happened in Seattle for the New York Times Magazine last week. Thank you all very much for being on our program. In a moment, from the depths of the Black Sea, 1,000 years of military history perfectly preserved. Back in a moment with To the Point from Public Radio International.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
Warren Alney here with today's Talking Point. Some 40 shipwrecks have been discovered in the depths of the Black Sea off the coast of Bulgaria. They've been photographed by robots using high-resolution techniques. The reaction from archaeologists? We couldn't believe our eyes. That's according to William Broad, Pulitzer Prize-winning science reporter with The New York Times. Hi, good to have you back on our program.
Hey, great to be here, Warren.
Tell us about these ships, and what did they see that they couldn't believe?
Well, the bottom of the Black Sea is a very unusual place because oxygen doesn't get down there, so it means you have no critters. So when ships sink, and they have for thousands of years on the Black Sea, they go down to the bottom and they just stay there. It's like you said in the lead-in, it's a museum. And these archaeologists went out there and went out with the ships and the robots, and for the first time, they kind of opened the door to this place, to this dark museum, and they saw, more than 1,000 years of ships down there. 44 in all kinds of incredible states of repair. I mean, you could see ropes coiled on the decks. You could see, you know, very finely carved decorations on the tillers. You could see all kinds of detail that is absolutely gone in, you know, the Pacific or the Atlantic Ocean. The wood deteriorates, critters eat it, it disappears. But at the bottom of the Black Sea, it's still there.
What can they learn from this?
Oh, man. What can't, you know, it's so much lost history, right? They're going to learn about trade routes. They're going to learn about contacts between different civilizations that they weren't aware of before. It's really, you know, a bunch of question marks. They're so excited. One guy, a wonderful archaeologist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution on Cape Cod, was saying it's likely that there are parchment and books and written materials preserved inside the hulls of these lost ships. I mean, just imagine, you know, finding, you know, lost manuscripts from the 12th century that nobody knew even existed, right? I mean, it's kind of a, you know, one of the archaeologists was describing how they felt when they found this medieval ship down there, and he said, "We were like, you know, little kids in a candy shop. We just couldn't believe our eyes. It was too good to be true."
Well, does this suggest then that they're going to use robots to go down inside the ships and try to recover what might be the lost parchments and books and other such things?
They haven't said. This is a 3-year project, and at this point, they're just looking, right? They haven't said publicly whether they're going to try to, you know, open it up and go in there. Bulgaria, which is the partner in this project, has signed a United Nations convention for taking care of what they call cultural heritage and not trading it on open markets. You know, it's considered a public public ownership. So if they did that, what they would be doing would be retrieving artifacts to put on public display in museums, not, you know, getting involved with treasure hunters and trying to, you know, make a bundle off this stuff. So who knows? This is, they say, and I think they're right, this is the beginning of something big, because there's maybe tens of thousands of these wrecks down there at the bottom of the Black Sea, and these guys have just sort of opened the door on it. So there's going to be other ships that are going to be found. Ships are going to be excavated. Who knows what they're going to find?
You describe the Black Sea as not having oxygen at those depths. Is this the only sea that's like that? Is it deeper than other seas? Is that the reason it's able to preserve these things the way it does?
Good question. It's unique. And it's unique because there are all these big rivers in Eastern Europe that flow into the Black Sea and bring a lot of fresh water. And the Black Sea also gets salty water from the Mediterranean. What happens is you form this fresh water layer on top that's oxygenated, but there's so much of it that it just never mixes with the salty, you know, denser water down below, so the oxygen never gets into the salt water. That's unusual. The Black Sea is the only sea like that on the planet, so this is a very unique spot. And what's surprising to me is archaeologists have known about this for, you know, more than a half century. And everybody's been, you know, kind of nibbling around the edges and talking about it. And wouldn't it be great to go out and, you know, really do a good expedition? Now somebody finally did it. They finally opened the door.
Given the concern about preserving cultural heritage, what's to prevent some rogue millionaire from getting together some equipment and going down and trying to loot the ships?
Well, they haven't released the positions of any of them that I'm aware of, and it's a very expensive proposition. They had a huge ship out there on the water this past fall. You can't hide these kind of operations, and the Bulgarians are very interested in keeping tight control over their territorial waters and not letting, you know, rogue billionaires go messing around with their cultural patrimony. So they have a deep interest in not letting that happen, and it's very hard to do on the sly. You need a giant boat at least 200 feet long with all kinds of fancy equipment, and, you know, they come out of ports and people talk, and this is not like the wide Pacific. The Black Sea is a much smaller body that people, there are a lot of eyeballs around there.
Is Bulgaria funding the research that's been done already?
No, No, that's one of the cool mysteries in the middle of this big story. This is funded by, we don't know who, a mystery benefactor at a private charity in the UK. And when I talked to the archaeologists and did my research, I kept kind of pressing in a gentlemanly way to try to find out who was the sugar daddy behind this whole thing, or sugar mama. And I couldn't find out, and I didn't press it. But there's some deep pocket out there who has decided to help these archaeologists open this door. And I don't have any idea who it is.
A sugar person. Have you seen any of the pictures?
Oh, yeah. That's the thing that blew us away. When these came across our computers back in October, my editors and I were all agog because we'd never seen any. I'm kind of an old hand at this stuff. I went down to the bottom of the Pacific in Alvin, down a mile and a half, and I wrote a book called The Universe Below. I've followed this field for decades, and I'd never seen anything like these pictures. So we were all just flipped out, and I said, I'll get right on it and report it out and try to, write up the best story I could. And it turned out to be even better than I expected.
You sound as excited about it as you say the scientists are.
Well, it's infectious, right? I mean, that's the beauty of my job. I get to talk to all these interesting people who are, cutting on the frontiers of science and technology. And this, it's pretty exciting.
What sort of history are we talking about? Are we talking about ancient trading civilizations? Which ones might be involved?
Yes. Bob Ballard, the guy who discovered the Titanic, got a glimmer that this would be a good place to go. And back early in, I think it was 2002, he did a Black Sea expedition. And bingo, he found a ship from ancient Greece.
Wow.
That one, was filled with what they call amphoras, these clay jars of antiquity. I think it was 2,500 years old. So the Black Sea was just, littered with Greek colonies. And then, during the Byzantine Empire, they took over and there were all kinds of colonies. And the Venetians came, right? And the Genoese came and everybody, the Black Sea, it was like this great trading area, the Ottoman Empire.
Okay, we're out of time. We're just going to fade out as you describe all of the things that might be discovered as a result of this. Bill Broad, author of The Universe Below and New York Times science reporter, he's been telling us about the extraordinarily well-preserved shipwrecks recently discovered in the depths of the Black Sea. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.